Moving on. As director of the unit here, do you still actually get to do some of your own research in-house?
I've got a big lab who does the search kind of for me. Like, I go and annoy them every now and then about what they're doing. So, I've got a big lab. Yeah, I've got very senior postdocs who work with me. I don't get to do an experiments anymore. If I was just going in the lab looked horrified and then laugh. And it's very sad. So up till I took over the unit, I was always in the lab. Not the whole time, but I like being in the lab with people because also they will ask you small questions. It's quite a different relationship you have with the staff. And I've got the most lovely team ever. And it would just be nice to be able to spend more time with them. I'm not sure they think the same, but anyway... That's what's sad. But yeah, I get to kind of see the end bit of the experiments.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know from my own experience, just training up as a toxicologist myself, actually just being in a room with people that know what they're talking about and are involved in these projects, it's the little things that you overhear and the little questions that you can often ask, which I find a very... they end up being the things that you keep with you and the most important sources of any information and any learning particularly. And it's just nice to have that sort of atmosphere where you can, you can feel like you can learn stuff just by, for want of a better word, by osmosis and just from being immersed in it. And it's although we have the connection in some way, via the internet and stuff like that, with calls and stuff like that, there's always when you go to call somebody up to ask a question, there's always something in the back of your mind that's sort of thinking, do I need to ask this? Whereas, if you just sat there and you're just in there, you just might come out with it.
So were you any good in the lab?
Great in the lab. Messy, but great. I love doing experiments. It's the most fun, right? And towards the end, when I was, taking a bigger administrative role and writing grants and papers and things when I was in Nottingham before I moved, I did run experiments and I did do some of them, but quite often I'd go and give people a hand. So it might help them with their experiments or things that they hadn't done and I'd done a lot of. So, boring stuff, but still necessary, like purifying antibodies of people, setting up things from scratch, setting up new assays, passing things on. Occasionally doing some repeat experiments. We had to get N=3 for, before we submit anything. So they've done the ones that look pretty and I'm just doing the kind of want the filler to just prove that it's all right. So that sort of thing would go and do. I hated doing PCRs, just hated it. I don't know why. I could never get the temperature right and I used to have a go. And then there was a lovely postdoc who used to work on the same bench as me who could cope with me being messy, me stealing his solutions. And then he would take pity and generally do my PCR. But I was very good at Western blots so, and other things as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think every biologist has some sort of horror story or, just some sort of bugbear with doing PCRs. We've all sort of done it as part of our undergraduate degree or something, and we've all experienced all of those frustrations for sure.
I think it's a lot easier now. It was because, at the time, it's so long ago, you had to optimise everything, the magnesium concentration. Yeah, anyway, it's just not my thing.
So much more is automated now.
Yes, it is. No, absolutely. That's the one thing I didn't enjoy doing, but everything else, I just loved doing experiments. It was so much fun.
You talked a bit about the size of your lab, over 100 people. Do you have a mix of senior, mid-career and early stage toxicologists?
Right across the unit, we have a big mix. What we've done in terms of the more senior people, we've recruited in expertise in area. So, for example, we've got two new people with expertise, relatively new in epigenetics, who've not worked in tox before, but they love the fact they've moved into tox because they can see that it offers them a wonderful niche that no one else is doing. As they've got to learn more about the science, they get how really exciting it is. So that's been really good. So we've got some senior people, and then, we've got a lot of PhD students here, so that's the most junior level. Well, no, I've got research assistants as well as junior people. We've got a couple of students in the unit at the moment who are working as research technicians, but they're partway through their undergraduate degree as well. They're doing a year out, so we're training some people there as well. And then we've got quite junior postdocs. And then because we're a unit, we've got some people who've got permanent postdoc jobs. They're like hen's teeth for most people. And these suit people who love being in the lab and don't want my job. because they think all the kind
too
of
much admin.
All the admin and all the kind of rubbish I have to deal with. So they just get to do the fun bit. So I write the money and do the grants, but then they just do the experiments.
Spend your money.
Spend the money. They do the experiments and the papers. And I'm trying to make sure that I've got some wonderful senior people in my lab who've worked with me for a long time, who utterly trust in what they're doing, very, very careful, really talented scientists. So we've got a whole mixture, actually. It's different from a normal university department, but maybe not so different from industry when we've got people with permanent contracts who are staying at that level, because that's they want, not they couldn't go on, they could, but that's what they really like doing best, and they don't really want to run a whole group themselves. And the challenges, but, you know, it's exciting that can go with that as well.
And so you mentioned some people have actually jumped into toxicology. What sort of fields and areas have you seen them come in from?
The field and areas match. So we've got, so Mary McFarlane, who's here, did her degree in toxicology. Well, pharmacology, she did toxicology PhD. But she's one of the few people who's actually a toxicologist from early career. Most people have come into it later. And what I've had to do, because the questions we need to address are very, very broad, particularly in the newer medicines like the immune checkpoint inhibitors. So for that, we've recruited in immunologists. And then they get the problem because they see it, you know, they're medics, they see it in the clinic. And so they're really motivated to do more research in that area, to have better predictive power for who's going to do well and badly. So we've got quite a lot of experimental medicine that goes on here as well. And the epigeneticists, again, they've come from, one of them's come from background of working on diet and epigenetic modification, but is really into the tox angle. Most large pharmaceutical companies are developing epigenetic modifiers, and they need to understand the on and off target effects associated with some of those drugs. Generally, they're in an anti-cancer area where the risk-benefit ratio is different, as you know, but as they move into treatment for other things, you've got to have a greater safety profile for some of these newer drugs coming through.
Mm. That's what I love about toxicology, actually. We call on those specialists. They could be a dermatologist or an epigenetic specialist, and we pull them into the field.
The MLC wants to put forward, help with future strategy for us as part of our move to Cambridge. And so I had to give a presentation to very, very senior MLC scientists. And they were blown away by the whole thought of what we do and said, it's really exciting, which it is. And I think it's not... the name still has connotations of people killing lots of rats with fire retardant, right? Which is not what we do at all, in the slightest. None of us do that. And that's different. That's kind of, you know, animal testing, and that's not toxicology. That's not what the science is about. So I think that's the trouble. But I think actually there is a gradual change now with things coming through, and people really getting to understand this is a very exciting science in its own right that has to be done up front and in parallel with drug development. And, you know, AZ in particular brought in new models, and their tox, you know, and others as well, carries along at the same time as their drug development, because you can't do it all and then find out that you've made a poison at the end, right? So you've got to do it in parallel, and one has to inform the other.
Yes, this is something I really wanted to ask you about in the new product development, new chemical development area. Why is toxicology so important, and when does it need to come in to the product development life cycle?
Up front and in parallel. So you take, if you take an existing thing, you change it a bit, you need to run the tox assays or to do more mechanism. So if you have really, really detailed mechanistic understanding of exactly what your drug does, then that does stop problems later down the line. But then, of course, you've got tissue dependence, cell dependence of things as well that has to be taken into account. But yeah, we don't have to be the killjoy at the end. We need to be part of the development process to make sure things, you know, that medicine safety is up front.
As you say, safety by design.
By design, with everything that's been done. And, you know, so many new chemicals are being brought through. The thing I think for the challenge in terms of chemicals is that, you know, there are, it's the kind of polypharmacology that's the issue. It's not too bad that we can look at one chemical, one effect. It's when you're having mixtures. And we've got one program that's like a cross-unit thing we're trying to set up to start with, to start looking at some more complex issues. It's going to require a lot of computational power and probably sort of an AI type approach to start solving and deconvoluting some of these more complex things of what we are and aren't exposed to during a live course?
This is it. Our models are so simplistic and they can only model the exposure to that chemical rather than the exposure to all of the chemicals we've come into contact with that day or that year.
I mean, what's been an eye-opener for me is we've recruited, which I wasn't intending on recruiting, which just seems such an amazing opportunity, is somebody who works in the microbiome. And you put that in the mix, oh my, does it make it complicated? So, you know, you've got within you, a kilogram of gut bacteria that is busy carrying out binary transformations on everything you take in, some of which are more toxic, some of which are less toxic. And then there's a lot of evidence coming through about how that influences medicines. And companies are not quite into this yet. I've said they cannot steal the person who works for us in that space. So he's just, for example, had a recent paper out in Nature, which shows that some type of bacteria, the bioaccumulation, they don't transform the drug, they just accumulate it. So you take it in and it never gets to the patient because it's taken up by the bacteria. And what I didn't know, so something like metformin, for example, doesn't work if you inject it. It has to go through the gut.
Well, okay.
Yeah. And then there's plenty of other examples that are well published of some anti-cancer drugs that actually some individuals have gut microbiota that make it actually much worse and end up with very bad gut toxicity, not because of the drug itself, because of what it's been turned into. So that's also going to really add such an important area. And maybe some of the idiosyncratic toxicity that we see is down to, it's not going to be everything, of course it's genetics, etc., but quite a lot of perhaps of the unexplained things could be due to differences in gut microbiota as well.
In the future, we're thinking about these personalised medicines. Not only do we need to think about DNA, but now we also need to think about your microbiome.
Absolutely, completely. It's really, really important, and we haven't up till now. It's just scratching the surface.
I mean, this is a great time to segue. So we've been speaking about things like AI coming into toxicology, looking at not just single substances, but mixtures thereof, and obviously the microbiome is so important and yet so varied, I think, from not just organisms, but probably from person to person as well. With that in mind, what do you think toxicology is going to look like in, say, 5 years' time? And then, by extension, what do you think it might look like in 50 years' time?
Oh, goodness. I think we're moving away, in terms of, you look at the pharmaceutical industry, they're moving away from kind of just drugs per se, chemicals is what we would consider to be a drug. And if you look at the portfolio of someone, for example, like AZ, that's just one of the things they do. And they've got a whole range of other things they do as well. Protax, for example, that's a new big thing going forward. All the oligos, all the RNA-based therapies, all the protein-based therapies. I think we need to understand how they work, the on and off target toxicities associated with newer agents going forward. I mean, what would be lovely in 50 years' time in terms of drug tox, we have enough understanding of structure-activity relationship, is that actually what you can do is you can put your chemical in, and it'll say, this is safe, this is not safe, or this has contraindications for this, and this. You can do that a little bit now, but actually to be able to take that, and I think that will come. So with all the work that's been done now on protein structure, this massive thing that's come out recently where you can modify, identify almost any structure for any protein with some of the new things that have come out, I think that will be a reality. You can put that in and see. But then in the same way, you should be able to model that for an RNA, for a protein, etc. So I think it'll become, we'll be out of a job. I don't know. There'll all be new things coming through, but actually it will be very computerized, and a lot of the mechanistic things we do is to use that information to have proper predictive power up front for everything we do, and that will make a big difference.
For me, one of the big things is confidence in these new technologies and QSARs and in silico. When do you think we'll gain the confidence?
Once we have the data, I think it just needs lots of data to populate those studies, and then you have the confidence, because, you know, if you know X does X, then it's going to be the same in whatever system you're in. Then you can be very confident in what you're doing. But you need very detailed mechanistic understanding. That's what's key. You don't want to just superficially look at the surface of things. You need to really delve deep.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way of sort of summarizing that is, you know, for years we probably looked at what, and increasingly we're looking at why. I think probably in certainly in academia that's been more of a focus, but definitely in industry, I don't think it's necessarily been so much of a focus as to why things are happening. It was just the what is happening. But we are slowly sort of seeing a shift towards why and how.
Yeah. No, I think so. I think industry's doing some wonderful work at the moment, and you see the papers that are coming out from industrial labs. And we work very closely with a lot of industry, which we really enjoy, actually. And it's important for us that it's not an esoteric academic exercise, that actually we're doing real-world things with real-world drugs. So that's what's really important for us going forward, that we can actually add value.
Yeah, absolutely.
So linked to thinking about alternatives you mentioned earlier, how do you think we can move away from using animal models?
There's lots of clever things we can do to reduce numbers straight up, but actually they're not great for predicting human tox. We all know this. It's legislation that requires two non-primate models first, right? Not necessarily the toxicologists who are asking for this. And actually some of these cell-based models are very, very good and very, become more and more sophisticated now. I think the lab on the chip stuff, and with some of the 2D, 3D, with proper microfluidics going in there, that will give proper predictive power of what's going on, when, particularly when you can have this whole, you know, human chip things, when you're linking up different organs on a chip. I think that will start really bringing, and some of that's being done now, and it's lovely work, and some of that will be bringing that together. If you look at someone like Unilever, where they have no animal testing, it's not allowed at all, even flies, that they don't use animals, and they're developing a lot of model systems, organoid models. I mean, for the mesothelioma work we've done in the unit, patients have been very generous and giving us small amounts of tumour, and actually then you've got a 3D piece of someone with a proper architecture, and you can keep these little micro things, you know, available for sort of a week. You can do a lot of testing on those, and that's very predictive. And there's kind of breast cancer models as well, when you can do that too. So actually, there's other ways forward, and with 3D complex organoid models, there'll be better heart models coming forward as well. That'll make a really big difference to testing. We have to move away from animal testing. I mean, the big issue, I think, is testing for drugs that can be used in pregnancy. So what are there? 15,000 registered drugs. I think it's 7 out of those are registered for use in pregnancy. And what do you do for somebody who's got a chronic condition that needs managing? That's an issue. You're never going to be able to do that, because if you're looking at like a 1 in 10,000 event, you can't breed that number of rabbits to look for that event. It's just, you know, people do, right? But you're going to miss things, and then longitudinal effects as well. But there are better models coming through of that now.
Models for pregnant
testing, yeah. So cell models for that you can do on scale. At the scale you need to actually pick out the rare events. That's what you can do. And that needs to be cell-based. And I'm not a big fan, sorry for people who work on this, I'm not a big fan of the zebrafish model. Yes, you can get lots of zebrafish larvae, I guess you'd call them, but they're not human. They're just so far away. If you've got a very, very well-conserved gene, maybe, but for the most of the stuff, it's a fish, you know? It's not helpful. Just because you can get lots of them doesn't mean it's the right system to go into. So I think that the stem cell systems will be better going forward. And that is a serious issue, not having things that you can test in a pregnant model. And then that limits drug development that could really help women in those sort of situations.
Yeah, really important. We're doing this for early stage toxicologists, and so I want to give them a little bit of help and advice from someone experienced as yourself. So I wondered if you could share some of the most important lessons you've learnt in your career so far.
Oh, goodness me. I think just believing in yourself that you can do it, I think that's important. I think when you're in the lab, celebrate the small successes. You know, it can be a bit of a lonely time if your experiment's not working. The thing is to question what you mean by not working. So it doesn't give you the answer you want, but that doesn't mean it hasn't worked. So you need to kind of celebrate the fact that, say, your gel ran nicely or your blot looks neat and tidy, and actually that makes it a good day. So just be happy with small things as you go along, and then that's quite a good thing. The other thing is, you know, I'm kind of untidy in the lab because I'm always doing 100 things at the same time. Don't do an experiment on your lab mate's stool. Makes you not very popular.
And you've tried that?
Oh yeah, I ran out of space, so I was using a stool. So that was, she wasn't happy. But I apologised.
So, if you could give one piece of advice to a new toxicologist just starting out, what would that be?
Oh, enjoy your time in science. Enjoy being in the lab. Enjoy the challenge. I think the other thing is as well, be very mindful of your workmates. So as you're a young researcher, the people you're with now will be with you probably your entire career. I have a very funny photo that was taken in a restaurant in Rome when I was, 23, 24. And round the table were my colleagues who are now heads of institution around the UK.
Wow.
And we were good friends then, and we're still good friends now. So that's the thing. Just, you know, be mindful, be pleasant, be kind, be cooperative. It makes your life a lot easier.
That's quite a cohort.
It was a cohort, yes. Yeah, it's extraordinary, actually.
Here's an off-the-wall question. So if you could have coffee with a historical figure, who would you choose and why?
Oh, Darwin. It has to be the kind of the thought, the insight that he had, clarity, and also the excitement that he must have had when he was travelling to go to the Galapagos Islands. That's a dream of mine, something I'd love to do, and to do that for the first time, and the whole work with his finches and everything. Yeah, absolutely. He would be the one person.
I know it feels very different, but I feel like we're in that sort of stage of discovery again. I don't know which wave you'd call it, the fourth or... Ooh.
I mean, I go as far as to say we've always been in that phase of discovery and we've never stopped. In fact, it probably just escalates.
I think, you know, what's different now is that, and it's always been the way, right? So actually technology drives invention and speed of science. And so if you think about it, when I was a student, we could only do northern blots. So it was one gene, one RNA. And then, you know, Ed Southern had the whole chip thing, and you could put things on glass chips, and all of a sudden, we could, you know, thought this was amazing. We could do hundreds of things at once. And now, the students today think nothing of just deep sequencing the lot, so you get 20,000 genes at one time.
Yeah, and I mean, that possibly is maybe the biggest thing in terms of, instead of having hypothesis-driven, like you say, looking at one particular thing, maybe there's a general consensus shift to actually just massive data generation. What can we actually see patterns wise in that, as opposed to going out and trying to find a particular goal, you are setting out for a particular goal, but part of what happens now is more as if you're searching for a goal within the sea of possibilities.
You can do. I think if you put it into the grant, it would be down as fishing, so you'd have to be very careful, right, how you did that. So I think it's important to have a hypothesis, but we can do it at scale. And then, of course, bioinformatics is the big thing.
Yes,
and
of course.
One advice would be learn to code in R. If you're starting out, you need to do this, because if you're going to be in the lab, it's all about big data.
Even as a scientist?
Oh, yeah. You have to as a scientist. Got to be able to do the coding. You've got to be able to interrogate your own data.
They dedicate time in the MSc courses, at least in Birmingham, to...
Thank you so much for your time, your energy.
That's fine. Is you'll get back your, you know, 20,000 data set. And if you can't code, you can't interrogate your data yourself. And you can give it to somebody else to do it for you, and that's fine, but you only get back their interpretation of your data. And also you can't ask the questions of the data in the right way. So that's so important for new students now. You need to be literate in this moving forward.
There you go. New hobby.
Coding.
So in the first bit of lockdown, that was my instruction to my students to improve their coding. They had to go online, do the courses. You then need to practice it and use it. And a lot of them are still, and postdocs are still learning. But, I mean, as a unit as a whole, we've got wonderful bioinformatic facility, but actually they're teaching and supporting rather than doing it for people, because you've got to have that. It's so important going forward. Everything is big data now.
Great.
So do you have a publication or a book that you'd recommend any listeners of the BTS Nest podcast?
Well, in terms of publication, there's a very, very nice paper in, I think it was in Nature Drug Discovery, that Mene Pangalos, one of the heads of AstraZeneca of the UK bit anyway, had co-authored. And he was explaining how AstraZeneca were doing their tox differently and really reducing the kind of valley of death for everybody between discovery and outcome. That's a really seminal review article, and I would recommend reading that. It just, I think it's field-changing, actually, in what they did and what they put together in how to remap how you answer the toxicology questions. That's really important in tox terms. Yeah, I think that's really worth a read.
Have we got time for one final question?
I think we do.
So there's one question we like to ask all our guests, and that is, what's the one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
How much fun it was going to be, and that it would be all right. I think it's always really worrying when you start thinking, you know, can I do this? Is it going to be okay? But look back, it's been, you know, the most fun, actually.
That's good to hear.
And then you go through periods, you know, as a postdoc. I mean, everybody has massive self-doubt. I think we all do as scientists. It's part of our training.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, but actually things tend to work out. If you stick at it and you work hard, you know, it will be fine. The other important thing is when to cut your losses.
Yes.
So when to stop doing an experiment because it's not going to work. So that's also important as well. So yeah, so some things I've done and done and done. Actually, why did I bother? I should have just said no after repeat two.
Great. Well, thank you very much for talking with us today. It's been a pleasure to come here and to meet you and to talk with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And it's just lovely to meet some younger people coming into toxicology. And if ever I'm at a conference at all and younger toxicologists are around, please come and talk to me. I'm really not scary.
I think we've learned that today.
Yeah, absolutely.